Neither of them were marked president, vice president. They just had the names of two candidates. Whoever got the most votes was president. Whoever got the second most was vice president. Now, the way you got around this to make sure that the head of your ticket got the presidency was to throw away one or two votes. Now, in 1796, the Virginians had refused to support Burr in the numbers they should have as vice president. So, as a matter of honor, they were obliged to cast every ballot, both for Jefferson and Burr. And Burr had promised that he would make sure one of his fellow New Yorkers would withhold one vote. It's a promise that Burr did not keep. And the result is that the electoral vote is, in fact, a tie, 73 each. Which means that the vote is going to get thrown to the Congress, as it were. What actually happens is senators and congressmen meet together in the Senate building, and they vote state by state. Well, Jefferson doesn't realize that Burr has backstabbed him, and he assumes he's won, and he starts assembling his cabinet. Meanwhile, Burr's cutting deals with the Federalists. And in fact, they prefer him to Jefferson, because Burr has very little conviction, and he's willing to give them almost anything he wants for power. When Jefferson realizes this, he goes to Adams, and he recalls this later to Benjamin Rush. When the election between Burr and myself was kept in suspense by the Federalists, and they were mediating to place the President of the Senate at the head of the government, I called on Mr. Adams with a view to have this desperate measure prevented by his negative. He grew warm in an instant and said with a vehemence he had not used towards me before, "Sir, the event of the election is within your own power. You have only to say you will do justice to the public creditors, maintain the Navy, and not disturb those holding offices, and the government will instantly be put into your hands. We know it is the wish of the people. It should be so." "Mr. Adams," said I know not what part of my conduct, in either public or private life, can have authorized a doubt of my fidelity to the public engagements. I say, however, I will not come into the government by capitulation. I will not enter on it, but in perfect freedom to follow the dictates of my own judgment. In fact, ultimately, it is claimed, at least by one of the people who votes for him, that he had struck a deal. But it's not something we can determine with any finality. Well, the result is that when the House and Senate begin voting by states, the result is that eight states vote for Jefferson, six for Burr, and two are divided. And this same result sticks for a full 35 ballots over a week. The critical swing vote is Delaware, and the critical swing vote there is one person. Federalist James Bayard. He will pick the president, and he leans towards Aaron Burr. Now, there's a great irony involved here, in that what actually gets Jefferson elected is not the intercession of Adams, or even the negotiation of his allies, but is in fact the intercession of his arch nemesis, Alexander Hamilton. Hamilton writes to Bayard in December 26th of 1800, "I could scarcely name a discreet man of either party in our state who does not think Mr. Burr the most unfit man in the United States for the office of president. Disgrace abroad, ruin at home, are the probable fruits of his elevation." And in fact, this was when Hamilton spoke of Caesar. The man he thought was actually the American Caesar was Aaron Burr, because he was unprincipled. He thought that Jefferson, as a populares, as a gracchi, as it were, led the way to Caesarism, but he knew that Jefferson was, in fact, principled. "For heaven's sake, my dear sir, exert yourself to the utmost to save our country from so great a calamity. Let us not be responsible for the evils which, in all probability, will follow the preference. All calculations that may lead to it must prove fallacious." Well, Bayard's still not convinced. And finally, on January 16th, he writes him another very impassioned letter. And this one deals with Jefferson. And while it's not particularly flattering, it shows that at some level, Hamilton does respect Jefferson and does understand him, perhaps better than some of Jefferson's own colleagues and partisans do. "I admit that his politics are tinctured with fanaticism and that he is too much in earnest in his democracy, that he's been a mischievous enemy to the principal measures of our past administration, and that he is crafty and persevering in his objects, that he is not scrupulous about the means of success, nor very mindful of truth, and that he is a contemptible hypocrite." All right, well, this is pretty damning stuff here. I mean, this is hardly the sort of endorsement you'd expect. But listen to what follows. "But it is not true, as is alleged, that he is an enemy to the power of the executive, or that he is for confounding all the powers in the House of Representatives. Now, in fact, Jefferson had argued along those lines, that the president's role was really foreign policy, and that the Congress's role was actually to legislate.